From News Talk 580 1059 KMJ, this is the Matty Report, Valley Views Edition. Now here's your host, Mark Kepler.
When it comes to politics, there's a helpful saying, ignore the words, follow the money. Like other states, every year the California governor and legislature negotiate a new budget. The end result reflects their true values and priorities. For Californians who pay taxes, however, the state budget process is a mystery. Our guest, Scott Graves from the California Budget and Policy Center, will tell you how the state budget is put together and how your tax dollars are spent. Following the Money, a primer on the California budget process.
Additional funding for the Matty Report made possible by a grant from the wonderful company, harvesting health and happiness around the world. From the California Channel at the State Capitol and the Matty Institute, it's the Matty Report with Executive Director of the Matty Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. We've all heard the saying that actions are more important than words. That's particularly true in government. If you really want to know a politician's real priorities, you need look no farther than the budget they're proposing. But budgets can be difficult for the average voter to understand. We're fortunate to have an expert, Scott Graves, who's the Director of Research for the California Budget and Policy Center, here to help explain the California budget process. Welcome to the Matty Report.
Thank you. I will do my best.
Okay. Well, first, can you explain where the money comes from to pay for the California state budget?
Well, ultimately, the money comes from California's taxpayers, either through the state personal income tax, state sales taxes, when we all go to the store and buy something that's taxed, we're contributing to the state budget. And also those of us who are paying federal taxes, a lot of that money is coming back to California. So that money all flows back into the state budget and is accounted for in a couple ways. We have federal funds in our state budget that makes up about one-third of the budget. Mm-hmm. That's just over $100 billion in the coming year. And then state funds make up about two-thirds of the state budget. That's around $180 billion. The largest state fund is called our general fund, not a very exciting name for a fund, but that's sort of the fund out of which our legislators and governor can apportion dollars for any purpose allowed by law. There are no strings attached to those general fund dollars, and that's the biggest portion of state spending.
It's interesting, you know, you're saying about $300 billion total-ish, $287. And people throw around $1 million like it's budget dust in Sacramento.
Yeah.
It's not that big a deal, right?
Yeah.
When you look at a billion-dollar budget, it isn't that big a deal.
Right. Until you get up to a billion or more, that's when you're talking real money.
Okay. It's always an interesting concept. So you stated that the state budget is a local budget. How so?
I think a lot of people think that because the budget is crafted in Sacramento, that all of the dollars remain in Sacramento. But the reality is the state budget sends money out across California every year, and very few of those dollars actually remain in Sacramento. So that's why when we're talking about the state budget, it's important to think of it as not being just some state-level thing, but it's actually providing a lot of services that are flowing out at the local level.
Yeah, but sometimes when you think about that, it's kind of pass through that the state really has with the budget and with revenue. It's almost like he who has the gold makes the rule. So sometimes the state can put strings attached to the local governments, I suppose. You know, there's a lot of public services supported by the state budget. Can you talk about a few of those?
Yeah, I mean, the biggest one that a lot of people are surprised by is K-12 public education. I think a lot of Californians think that most money for their public schools comes from their local property taxes. And property taxes do play a big role in public education. But most of the money that public schools are spending every year is coming from our state budget. So that's one big piece of it. Higher education also gets a lot of money from the state budget. The community colleges, the California State University, there are 23 campuses around the state, the 10 University of California campuses. We have a Medi-Cal health coverage program.
That's very big.
Very big. That's a $100 billion program in California, federal and state money. We've got a lot of services that help families in need, including at-risk children through the foster care and child welfare services programs. And, of course, we have a lot of public safety expenditures at the state level.
Right.
We have 34 state prisons scattered around California. We spend more than $10 billion general fund dollars per year on our correction system. So that's another big piece of spending.
It's interesting you say corrections. A lot of people assume, if you ask them, you know, what does the state spend the money on? A lot of people, I think, will say corrections and crime, but that's actually, it's big, but it's kind of the, it's not one of the biggest expenditures.
Right. The biggest expenditure in the state budget, just speaking about the general fund, is K-12 education. If you look at correction spending at the state level, it's been dropping in recent years because of the state's efforts to reduce incarceration. Still around 8 to 9% of our general fund budget is going into our prison and parole system. Mm. But that's smaller than what we spend on higher education as a share of the budget, and much smaller than what we spend on K-12.
Yeah, I think the number that's on K-12 is about 40% on K-12 and community college, and then another 10% or so for higher education. So if you just compare prisons, you know, incarceration, about 8 or 9% compared to, let's say, K-12, which is like 40%, and we're talking, you know, five times as much for education. I think people would be surprised by that.
Right.
You know, it's interesting. The state budget is actually a bill. You described it, though, as, quote, a bill of a different kind. What did you mean by that?
So a lot of people are familiar with the policy process in the legislature, where you have a bill and it gets introduced in one house and it moves through various committees, goes to the floor, then it goes to the next house. The budget bill is not like that. It is a bill, and here's an example of a recent budget bill.
It's light
over,
reading.
It's over 700 pages long with thousands and thousands of numbers in it. But it's different from your standard bill for, you know, a couple of reasons. One is that it is moving through budget committees in the legislature, not through policy committees. Okay. It's generally moving with other bills as part of a package. It's never alone. It's never flying solo. It's always got 20, 30, or 40 bills attached to it that help to
implement. Barnacles on a ship.
Yeah, right. There they are. You can't have a budget bill without the what are called trailer bills or budget-related bills. And also the bill is different not only because it's so long, but because it covers everything that state government does. It funds an array of programs and services for a single fiscal year.
Wow. So thanks for that overview of the state budget. Up next, we're going to talk about the what, who, and when of the state budget. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute, and I'm talking with Scott Graves, the Director of Research for the Nonpartisan California Budget and Policy Center. So the California budget seems to have a language all its own. It's like a foreign language. And there are some key terms, though, that most people should know. So let's go through a few key terms.
Sure.
One is the governor's proposed budget. What's that?
So the proposed budget is the spending plan that the governor unveils or releases every January after a several months long process within his administration to figure out what he wants his budget to look like. So these are very big documents. This is not for the faint of heart. Here's an older version from the Gray Davis administration. It's as big as a big city telephone book, hundreds of pages long, with a lot of very almost unintelligible jargon in many places and filled with numbers. So this is where you go if you want to know, you're interested in a particular department or agency spending, you want to know how much they spent last year, how much they're estimated to spend in the current year, and how much the governor is proposing to spend in the next fiscal year.
Put the green eye shades on.
Yes.
Okay, so then we've got the governor's budget summary. What's that?
Okay, here's another somewhat older version of that. The summary
seems a little smaller.
It's smaller. This is the narrative that accompanies the big budget. So this is more text and fewer numbers. This is where you go if you want to have a better understanding of the governor's revenue outlook. Does he think revenues are going to be up or down for the next fiscal
year? Explains the numbers.
Right. His economic outlook. Does he have any major policy initiatives that he wants the legislature to pass? So that's where you would go to find all of those things, plus the governor's rationale for his budget. This is the governor's view of the world.
Okay. Then we've got the May revise, or the May revision. A revise is probably not grammatically correct, but that's what people call it. What is that?
So the May revision is the governor's second bite at the apple. Essentially, he unveils his budget proposal in January. A few months go by. Legislators look at it. And then after we know what personal income taxes look like in California in April, the governor then releases tax day. We all pay our taxes in April. Or, you know, I hope we do. then the governor takes a look at that and says, okay, revenues are better than I thought they'd be. Revenues are worse than I thought they'd be. A lot of things have changed in the last few months. He revises his budget proposal and releases it by May 14th, and then legislators take a look at that.
Okay, and then you've got budget bills and you've got trailer bills. Can you talk about those for a second?
So the budget bill, this is the several hundred pages long document that gets introduced every year. And there can be more than one budget bill. A lot of people think there's only one budget bill. Often there's more than one because they make changes to it throughout the year. But the budget bill essentially contains thousands of appropriations that tell agencies, boards, commissions, universities that they can spend a certain amount of money from a certain fund for a certain amount of time for a specific purpose.
And I'm guessing, like, if you're in the UC, you're going to be focusing specifically on the section on University of California.
You want to be able to
see. Not going to read the whole thing.
Right, what the governor is proposing in your area, exactly. Right. So the trailer bills, these are the bills that accompany the budget bill, because the budget bill doesn't tell you much beyond the numbers, how much can be spent. The trailer bills or budget-related bills, such as this one, for example, they can be bigger or smaller than this. They sort of explain how state law is going to have to change in order to implement the policies and spending assumed in the budget
bill. Are those the barnacles on the ship we were talking
about? Barnacles on the ship. You might have, in years past, maybe 20 years ago, there would have been 10 of these accompanying the budget bill. During the Great Recession, when we had the big deficits in California a few years ago, there were 40 or 50 of these trailer bills. In recent years, it's been more in the range of maybe 25 or 30. So there's a lot. There are a lot of bills that move along with the budget bill through the process.
Then we've got some key players in the process. So quickly, you know, Department of Finance.
Department of Finance is the governor's chief fiscal policy advisor. They prepare all of the governor's budget-related documents. This is going on in any given year from July through June, basically the whole year.
Okay,
they're always at work.
Then you've got the assembly committees and the Senate committees.
Yes. So the budget committees in the legislature review the governor's proposals and they craft their own version of the budget before they go into final negotiations with the governor.
Okay, and then we get the Legislative Analyst Office.
The LAO, they are the advisors to the legislature. They essentially work for state lawmakers and not for the governor. They look at the governor's budget, they advise the legislature on it, and they put out publications.
Let's talk about the timeline for the state budget. It's ongoing. This thing is, you know, 12 months a year, but let's start at January.
Okay.
Kind of walk us through the timeline for the state budget from January.
Okay, you made a key point there. Before you get to January, there's a lot that goes on. So it's really important for Californians to understand that it is a cyclical process. There's always someone in Sacramento thinking about the state budget. If it were a sport, there would be no off-season. So there's always some aspect of the budget process going on. January, the big event is the governor releases his proposed budget for the upcoming fiscal year. That must be a balanced budget, meaning he has to show that revenues equal or exceed the spending that he is proposing. That has to be done by January 10th.
Okay. So he's projecting that, and then it goes to the legislative committee hearings sometime in the spring.
Right. March, April, early May, the legislature, both the Assembly and the Senate, will hold dozens of hearings digging into the details of the governor's proposals.
Okay. And then we've got May 14th is the governor's May revise.
Right. May 14th, that's the date when the governor puts out his updated budget proposal, taking into account how the world has changed in the previous 4 months.
And then there's legislative committees, you know, working in the Senate and the Assembly and during June. Then we got June 15th is the next big deadline.
June 15th, that's another constitutional deadline. The legislature is required to pass the budget bill. No other bills, just the budget bill by midnight on June 15th. If they miss that deadline, they lose their pay and their reimbursement for travel and living expenses for every day they're late.
That'll get their attention.
It's an incentive, and they have, since that rule went into effect 7 years ago, they've never missed a deadline.
Not too many, I'm guessing, not too many late budgets. And then we got July 1.
Start of the fiscal year. So we have a 12-month fiscal year. It runs July 1st through June 30th.
Okay, well, thank you very much for talking about the who, what, when, where, and why about the state budget process. Up next, we're going to talk about the state constitution and how it sets some kind of key rules of the road when it comes to the California state budget process. What are they? That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. We're talking with Scott Graves, the Director of Research for the Nonpartisan California Budget and Policy Center. You know, the California Constitution sets some important rules regarding the budget process. What are they? So one thing the California Constitution does is it talks about tax increases, and it requires a supermajority or a two-thirds vote. What are some of the taxes that require this two-thirds vote? What are we talking about?
Yes. Back in 2010, the voters passed an initiative that requires that any taxpayer who will be asked to pay a higher tax, that requires a two-thirds vote of the legislature.
Well, any is a loaded term. That's
So, I mean, you could imagine a situation where legislators want to cut taxes for 35 million people and raise taxes on five people. That bill would require a two-thirds vote because five people would be paying a higher tax.
Wow.
Really, so they really tightened up the rules through Proposition 26 back in 2010.
Now, you're hearing that a lot now with cap and trade. I mean, cap and trade, when they first proposed it, they said, oh, this isn't a tax. This is to deal with greenhouse gas emissions. But there's currently litigation asking whether or not the cap and trade charge is a tax, and if it does, it needs a two-thirds support of the legislature. So the governor now is working on that to try to get the legislature to reauthorize that.
Right. So that goes to the question of what is a tax and what is a fee.
Right.
The other thing that Prop 26 did is it expanded the definition of a tax. So many increases that used to be considered fees and the legislature could pass by a majority vote, they now require a two-thirds supermajority vote. So that's
it's kind of
raising
that
issue.
If it walks like a duck and talks like a duck, it's a tax. Just because you call it a fee.
They've got very clearly defined rules now. Yeah.
Yeah. In the past, the budget bill needed a two-thirds majority to pass. In 2010, you talked about this Prop 25, which allowed budget bills and trailer bills to pass on a simple majority vote. But what if you got a trailer bill or something that's part of the budget package? Does that need a two-thirds vote?
Yes. So any bill that's included in the budget package that otherwise requires a two-thirds vote still needs a two-thirds vote.
So you can't get around it?
No. So if you want to raise taxes, you need a two-thirds vote, even if you're doing it to balance the budget. If you want to put a constitutional amendment before the voters, you still need a two-thirds vote because the Constitution says so. You can't say, well, it's part of the budget, so it should pass by majority vote. No,
okay.
You need the supermajority.
Okay. Thanks for that clarification.
Yeah.
Okay, so in 2016, the voters approved Prop 54, and that said that bills have to be published at least 72 hours before the legislature takes any action. Mm-hmm. So since the state budget is a bill, how does the 72-hour rule impact the budget process?
That 72-hour rule applies to every bill, including the budget bill and budget-related bills known as trailer bills. So what this essentially means is the deadline for the legislature to pass the budget bill without being penalized is June 15th, midnight. That means if they have to have the budget bill in print for 3 days or 72 hours, they really have to have the budget done by June 12th. So one thing that has happened is there's already a compressed timeline between when the governor releases his May revision in mid-May and when they have to get the budget done. Now, Prop 54 has made that timeline a little bit shorter by backing up the date by which the legislature has to have a bill.
So it's really compressed time. I mean, I assume the legislature then is working some long hours.
Yeah, there's a lot of negotiations that go on between mid-May and early June. That's when the rubber really hits the road, and it's also when the process moves very quickly, and it gets harder for the public, Joe Q public, to see the process, what's going on, and to influence the process.
So we've got a lot of legislatures and probably news reporters are putting in some pretty long nights during that compressed period between the May revise and when the budget has to be done.
That's right. And now the real deadline is going to be June 12th, not June 15th.
No wonder I can't get anybody on the phone during that time. I think you just gave me the answer. I just want to go over one last thing because we talked about it earlier, and that was the penalties if a budget is late under Prop 25. What were the penalties again?
So if the legislature has not passed and sent to the governor the budget bill, just sent to the governor, he can veto it, he can do anything he wants with it. If they miss the June 15th deadline, every day that they're late, they forfeit their pay and the additional money that they get to pay the travel and living expenses. So they would forfeit that money. Since that rule went into effect in 2010, They have never missed the deadline. So there have been various reasons why we've had on-time budgets since Governor Brown came back into the governor's office. But, you know, probably a small role is played by the fact that if the legislature actually misses its deadline, they'll have to pay a financial penalty.
Yeah, and it gets their attention for sure. Well, thank you for providing that overview of some of the important rules of the budget process. Up next, you know, the people of California do have a direct say in the state budget process through the initiative and proposition process. It's called ballot box budgeting. And what impact does it have on the state budget? That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. We're talking with Scott Graves, the Director of Research for the Nonpartisan California Budget and Policy Center. As we've discussed, the governor and the legislature craft the state's annual spending plan according to rules outlined by the state constitution. California voters, however, have periodically reviewed and revised the state constitution, and that's had a profound effect on how the state budget process occurs. A great example of that is Prop 98, which was passed in 1998 and sets a guaranteed level of funding for K-12 schools and community colleges. So I'm guessing it's, I know it's pretty complicated from what I've read, but what is that, how is the minimum guarantee for education calculated, and can it be changed or modified?
So it is a very complicated formula that is used every year to figure out how much of the general fund will go toward K-12 schools and community colleges, which are also in the formula. There are three tests that apply under different economic and fiscal circumstances. So, you know, we're it's really complicated. The number of people who actually understand it could fit around this table right now.
I think one of the people who designed it actually said he sent his kids to Stanford based on his knowledge and what he was able to, you know, sell that for basically to other people,
right?
Because it's just so complicated.
It is complicated, but it is a key piece of the budget process every year, because until legislators and the governor have a good handle on how much the state is going to owe for Prop 98 to K-14 education, they don't really have a sense of how much of the state budget is left for other programs and services.
There's another one, Prop 2, the Rainy Day Fund, was approved by voters in 2014.
Right.
What impact on the state budget does that have?
So that has put in a fairly rigid formula that does require the state to set aside what amounts to billions of dollars every year into a rainy day fund to save for the next recession when things start to go downhill again,
right.
And also to pay off some of our budgetary debt, which includes unfunded pension liabilities.
Right.
So that is a new thing that the voters put in effect, a new priority that they wanted to see.
Yeah, it's interesting, and they're talking about, you know, about $10 billion in all the reserves to state government. But when you look back at the recession, the Great Recession, the state was running $20 billion deficit. So $10 billion sounds like a lot as a reserve, but, you know, based on recent history, maybe not enough. Okay, so 2016, Prop 55 was passed. It's kind of a continuation of a tax on wealthy Californians. What impact on the budget process?
So that will leave in place for another 12 years through 2030. The personal income tax rate increases on the highest income Californians. It does allow the sales tax rate increase that was part of the original initiative that put these tax increases in place back in 2012. That sales tax increase has expired. What Prop 55 does that's different, though, is that it requires during certain years and under certain circumstances some general fund dollars to go automatically to the Medi-Cal program, which provides health care to low and moderate income Californians. So it puts a new rule in there.
I want to ask you quickly about the state, this thing called a state mandate. What are they and how do they impact the state budget process?
So state mandates are essentially requirements from the state that local governments perform certain activities. Decades ago, and maybe not so long ago, the state would tell locals that it needed to do certain things and it wouldn't pay for them. The locals didn't like that, and they got voters to pass a couple of initiatives that tightened up the rules. So now, essentially, the state legislature, if it wants local governments to do something, it has to pay for it.
Okay.
If they're not going to pay for it, they have to suspend the mandate.
Okay, so we'll end with this last question. Overall, what is the impact of these voter initiatives and propositions on the state budget process? How would your impression be?
Well, it's essentially a way that the voters are setting priorities for their elected officials in Sacramento. So the voters have said, as we just talked about, that they want to be certain that a good share of the state budget goes to our public schools and community colleges every year. They've said they want to see a lot of money set aside in a rainy day reserve. So it doesn't completely tie the hands of our legislators and our governor, but it does impose some requirements on them that they have to follow every year when they build the budget.
Follow the money. If you really want to know what the priorities are for the state citizens or the governor or the legislature, follow the money. It's all in the budget. Well, I want to thank our guest, the Director of Research at the California Budget and Policy Center, Scott Graves. If you also want to stay up with state and local politics, you can sign up for our daily e-newsletter, The Maddie Daily, by going onto our website at maddieinstitute.org, or you can follow us on Facebook and Twitter.
You're listening to The Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition, on KMJ.
The state budget proposed by the governor in January came with a warning. Financial clouds are forming. What are the governor's fiscal concerns and budget priorities? Are the governor's economic projections too gloomy, too rosy, or just right? And how is the legislature likely to respond? We'll ask Mac Taylor, California's legislative analyst, Dan Walters from the Sacramento Bee, and John Myers from the LA Times. The governor's 2017 budget, cloudy with rain in the forecast.
Additional funding for the Maddie Report made possible by a grant from the wonderful company, harvesting health and happiness around the world. From the California Channel at the State Capitol and the Maddie Institute, it's the Maddie Report with Executive Director of the Maddie Institute, Mark Kepler.
Welcome. In January, the governor presented his 2017-18 budget proposal to the legislature. What are the governor's priorities, and will the state have the revenue sufficient to cover those priorities? Our guest is Mac Taylor, California's legislative analyst, the authoritative source for a nonpartisan analysis of the state budget. Welcome back.
Nice to be here, Mark.
So the governor identified a $1.6 billion deficit, indicating that the state's fiscal condition might be worsening. What's driving the governor's pessimism?
Well, I think from our perspective, his revenue numbers are, we think, maybe a little bit low. Back in November of 2016, when we did our last full-blown economic and revenue forecast, we had, for example, major tax revenues of $4 billion greater than what the governor is now proposing. Mm-hmm. And I think, if anything, we think the economic conditions, the stock market is considerably higher than it was in November. We think things are actually maybe a little bit better. So we believe that we may have a lot more revenues than what the governor is suggesting.
Yeah, and I think in the past when we've talked, you said, well, you know, Mark, the LAO's is a little bit closer to what actually happens in the governor's, and we'll just leave it at that. We'll see if this year is the same.
It may not be, but
if history is any guide. So what are the major features of the governor's budget? What would you say are the...
Well, when you have a budget problem, you're not going to be adding any new programs, right? Because you have to deal with that small problem. And it is small relative to the budgetary problems we've had in the past, certainly during the Great Recession. So the governor basically, I would call it a baseline budget. You just continue the things that you're doing. Schools do get some extra money, about a 3% increase. Colleges and universities get about a 4% increase. So some things are going up a little bit, but it's a pretty sort of standard budget. Let's fund, for the most part, what we funded last year.
So that's what's your overall impression of the budget then?
Well, I think the governor, once again, is trying to be cautious. He's very concerned about when the next downturn comes. And so he has concentrated putting monies aside in the reserve. And when you do spend money, spend a good chunk of it on one-time things so it's not there next year in case you can't support it. And generally, that's a strategy that we've been recommending to the legislature for many years. Be very cautious. Build up your reserves. Be careful on your new spending commitments.
And you've also, you know, things are going to change when the April tax receipts come in with the May revision, right? And
yes.
Then the uncertainty of what's happening at the federal level, I guess, is another thing to kind of think about. So what do you think about the governor's personal income tax estimate? Why do you think it's too low?
Well, and this is the biggie. I mentioned that we had $4 billion more. We actually had $5 billion more in personal income taxes, offset by some other differences that we had on other taxes. I think the two big differences, we think they're assumptions about how wages will grow, particularly in 17 and 18, we think are just maybe too low. And then, as we have had differences in the past on capital gains assumptions, the market is at all-time highs. And we're just not sure that the administration's capital gains revenues forecast
Because they rely heavily on that.
Well, yeah, it doesn't seem to mesh with their economic forecast of where markets are.
Right. They're saying one number, the economy is going to increase at a certain percentage here, but wages are not.
Well, or if the stock market is at this level, how can you have a slight decrease in capital gains year over year?
Okay. So you mentioned that the budget situation is going to change with the May revision, when April taxes come in. I don't suppose I can get you to guess how much it's going to change. Can I get you to do that?
No, you can't.
I didn't think I could, but I was going to ask the question. So if things are better than the governor projects, are there constraints on how that increased revenue can be spent?
Yes, I think that's a very good question. Let's just assume, for example, that our November number, that we have $4 billion more than what the governor's saying right now. Let's say it comes in $4 billion more. You would have to give about $1.5 billion of that, approximately, to schools under the Proposition 98
automatically.
Constitutional. You also would have to probably add some more money to our reserves because of Proposition 2 that the voters approved recently.
That money's going away quickly here.
Well, but even after that, you would have some money that would be available for other purposes. You could either build up your reserves, you could have some new spending commitments, either one-time or ongoing. But you would have a big chunk of it that she wouldn't have a lot of control over.
Right, right. You're not going to get the money and do whatever you want with it.
Not by any means.
Okay, so governor's proposed budget assumes no major changes in federal policy. But we've got a federal government now controlled by the Republicans. And you note in your report that there's really, quote, added uncertainty at the federal level. What are the implications for the state budget?
Well, there's implications on both the revenue and the spending side. So, for example, you've got a federal government now. Are we going to see tax cuts? Are we going to see certain things that will help stimulate the economy in the near term in particular? Well, that's a probability. Are you going to have – could that be offset by other actions taken, such as trade restrictions that could hurt California in particular? Mm-hmm. So the net effect of that, who knows, and when that might occur, you have – because of the prospects of personal income tax – rate reductions at the federal level, you might have people deferring on their capital gains. Mm. You have lots of uncertainty because of that. And then on the spending side, you also have the uncertainty about what's going to happen, for example, with the Affordable Care Act.
Right. So I guess you would say you should plan for a high level of uncertainty.
Typically, in our personal lives, if you have more uncertainty, you're more cautious on your spending and you put more money aside in your piggy bank.
Okay. Well, up next, we're going to have a discussion about how the governor plans to pay some of those big expenses like education and infrastructure. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute, and we're talking with the state's nonpartisan budget expert, Mac Taylor, with the Legislative Analyst Office, about the governor's proposed budget. So let's talk about some of the state's current ongoing expenses. K-12 education and community college, biggest part of the state budget, about 40%. Largely driven by formulas like Prop 98. So what are your thoughts about the major features of the governor's education plan?
You know, again, I think it's fairly straightforward. As in recent years, the governor's proposing to spend all of the increase for K-12 schools, not all, but virtually all of the increase towards what's called the local control funding formula. And this is formulas where we've set targets that we want to reach, and we're trying to close those gaps. And basically, the governor just says, let's, once again, as we have the last 3 years, really, let's put aside most of the money towards that goal.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. If you move it up to, like, the UCs and the CSUs, the governor's proposing a 4% increase for the UCs and 5% for the CSUs. But it's different this year. Last year, he appeared to say, you know, we want a tuition freeze to go along with this. This year, he's not asking for a tuition freeze. In fact, both the UC and the CSU are talking about increasing tuitions. Did the governor have any specific demands on higher education in terms of getting this increase? Kind of a, you know, you have to do this and then I'll do that?
Well, publicly, I'd say it's nothing real firm. He's still suggesting that he wants to see improvements in things like online education, improvement in graduation rates. But he's not, there's not that direct linkage. And he even in past years have acknowledged that a certain time he would be willing to consider or be okay with some tuition increases. So I think those things are probably being negotiated.
Yeah, and we will find out when it comes out in the final budget. Let me ask you about another governor's decision. He's basically defunding this thing called Coordinated Care Initiative. But it seems like it still have to do the major parts of it.
Yes.
Is this one of those unfunded mandates that the state sometimes imposes on local governments?
No, I don't think so. But it does involve an important funding decision between the state and counties that is going to be, I think, a really significant issue. The Coordinated Care Initiative is a pilot program that we did in about 7 counties. And all it's trying to do is provide more integrated care for seniors and disabled folks who have Medicare benefits, Medi-Cal, state Medi-Cal benefits, and state-provided human services benefits, and try to merge
in
them
one package, okay,
into sort of one package. Mm-hmm. It wasn't working, particularly with regard to these state social services, in-home supportive services. So I think the two key issues that the legislature has, do we still want to try to make this pilot work? Do we want to still integrate some of these social services? And secondly, if we don't, what are we going to do about the funding arrangements for the social service program? How much do the counties fund? How much should we fund?
But that's a lot of money. They're talking like $600
million. There's a lot of money at stake.
Yeah. Okay. So let's talk about something else that's kind of on the radar, and that is cap and trade. Could bring in $2.2 billion next year. That's what the governor's saying. But there's some uncertainty, however, surrounding the program. Can you briefly describe what the cap and trade program is? Why is there uncertainty? And what do you think ought to be done?
Oh, the cap and trade program is a mechanism, market-based mechanism, to try to ensure that it's a cap on emissions of greenhouse gases. You can't exceed that. And if you want to emit greenhouse gases, you have to have an allowance.
Okay.
And the state will sell those allowances.
So you're buying like a credit.
And you can buy it from the state. You can buy it from others. That's the trading part.
Okay.
The point is, it was only authorized through 2020.
Oopsie.
Well, not necessarily. But now people are, they want it to extend further. They want the program to achieve the goals of reducing our greenhouse gas emissions well below our 2020 levels.
Okay.
And the question is, do you still want to use cap and trade? If you do, do you have to reauthorize it? How do you reauthorize it? Is it to tax or not? Legal issue.
And if it's a tax, it needs a two-thirds vote.
It needs a two-thirds vote.
And so that's the big deal there.
And that, if you did provide that, it would probably bring some more stability to the markets, and you would probably have more successful auction sales.
And the governor, I'm assuming, is saying, you know, we can give you some money out of cap and trade, but first you got to pass this extension by a two-thirds
that
vote.
That appears to be what he's asking for.
Okay. Last year, there was a special session on transportation. A lot of talk about the deterioration of state highways. Nothing happened. So what is the governor proposing this year to deal with maintenance needs for state highways, and is it enough?
The governor is basically sticking with the plan he's had for a couple of years now of imposing a new registration fee and changing the way on gas tax, slightly increasing our gas taxes and changing the way that we do the formulas in order to raise several billions of dollars. And the point of this is we do need to maintain our roads better. We just don't spend enough money on routine maintenance.
You know, you mentioned, I want to mention that to our audience. You talk about the difference between maintenance and rehabilitation. And could you briefly describe the difference between maintenance and rehabilitation?
Sure. Think of if you have a road that would last, its useful life is maybe 60 years. Well, during that 60 years, you still maintain it, right? You see the folks coming in and putting the small overlays on it to fill the holes and even it out. At some point, you have to completely rehabilitate it.
So it's a difference between changing the oil in your car or replacing the entire engine.
Something like that.
Okay, well, there you go. Well, up next, we're going to get at the governor's take on the governor's budget from two of the most well-respected observers of state politics, Dan Walters of the Sacramento Bee and John Myers of the LA Times. That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. We're now joined by two well-respected observers of state politics, Dan Walters with the Sacramento Bee and John Myers with the LA Times. Welcome back to the Maddie Report.
Thanks. Thank you.
So, John, governor's revenue projections seem to be coming in with a double-barreled warning. downturn is inevitable, and the state's going to in for a rough ride now that the Republicans are in control in Washington. The Democratic-controlled legislature seems to be agreeing this year, and their demands are kind of tempered a bit. How is that likely is that to hold if the April seats come in a little different than what's projected?
Well, you just said it. I mean, the April tax numbers tell us the real story, right? We'll really find out what the state has got to spend. I don't know that Jerry Brown, since he has returned to Sacramento, has offered a budget that wasn't tempered or restrained. So this kind of played into his mindset. But that reemergence of a projected deficit is the thing that got a lot of attention, right? About $1.6 billion or so projected deficit. But there are disagreements, as there have always been, about revenue projections, whether the governor is being too conservative here. And yeah, to your point exactly, Mark, with what's going on in Washington, there's not a lot of Democrats who are saying, let's automatically spend it. There's not exactly like there'd be enough money to fill in the gaps if Washington started cutting funding to California. But I do think it has given people a little bit of pause to let's think it out.
Yeah. Now I ask you about, you know, the state's getting some, I guess, quote unquote, new sources of revenue. You've got Prop 55, which is the extension of the current income tax rates on the wealthy. You've got Prop 56, the $2 a pack on cigarettes. You've got Prop 64, which is legalization of recreational marijuana, but there's tax implications there for sure. It seems like voters and politicians every year are looking for a new source of tax that taxes someone else. So I'm wondering, who's up next?
Who's up next? Well, I think they've got to find out whether they're going to get money out of marijuana first. But none of this is going to be immediate. It has really no effect on the next budget. We have to hasten. The tax extension of the temporary taxes kicks in. It just extends, but it doesn't do anything for this year. Mm-hmm. In fact, the sales tax component of Prop 12 goes away pretty soon. Prop 30, mm-hmm. I should say. So, well, the answer is I think the one that everybody's looking at now is some sort of new transportation taxes, gas taxes or whatnot. The governor wants a gas tax increase. A lot of Democratic
maybe those people that drive electric cars are going to start.
Well, it would be everybody under the governor's plan. That would get
right, and so those people are the ones that I don't have an electric car, so, you know, sure, tax them.
Gas, but everybody would pay the gas tax. Everybody would pay the new registration fees, mm-hmm. and then the people who have electric cars are not going to pay the gas tax, but pay some new fees and so forth. That's going to be that's the next frontier, so to speak, in the tax front, is whether we're going to raise taxes by a pretty substantial amount to finance more transportation spending.
Yeah, something that's been kind of neglected for a while. John, let me ask you about the aspect of maybe losing money, and that's cap and trade. We know that's the pollution credits that they sell. The state makes some revenue off that. The governor's proposing $2.2 billion in cap-and-trade revenue, but only if the legislature extends it by a two-thirds vote, because it's kind of viewed as a tax, I believe, by a lot of people. So you think it's going to happen?
I don't know. That is one of the more interesting gambits out of this budget plan, right? Let's roll back the clock a little bit for those who haven't followed all of this. So California put its climate change law into place in 2006. The State Air Resources Board came up with the cap and trade system. It was encouraged to, but it wasn't mandated to put it together exactly as they did. It has generated money as companies have bought those pollution credits. But a lot of the money has been stuck over this debate about where to spend it. The governor, meantime, has a fear, as do advocates of the cap and trade program, about a lawsuit that has been making its way through the courts that had said exactly to your point, Mark, that it was a tax and it should have been passed by a supermajority of the legislature. So the governor's gambit this time is, hey, let's resolve all the legal issues and I'll let you spend the money.
And he does have a supermajority in the legislature.
He does, but a supermajority in name only in some ways. Democrats aren't all thinking alike, especially in the assembly. You've got a lot of business-aligned Democrats. I think this wrangling over the future of cap and trade, what it looks like, what it means, how business-friendly or business punitive it is one of the really interesting things to watch.
And there's one other aspect to this, is that the last year's auctions didn't generate very much money and sucked zero in one of them. And there's another auction coming up soon. And there's a little fear that this thing, until all the legal and political ramifications of this thing are resolved, if in fact they ever get resolved, then that these auctions are not going to be generating any money. So part of what the governor proposes to spend isn't there yet. And may not materialize.
And there's so many things to talk about. Let me just get this last question. We've got a minute left in this segment. I want to ask you about the federal government and Trump and President Trump and the Republican Congress and the implications for California. So, Dan, you know, Obamacare, ACA, looks like it's going away. We're not sure what it's going to be replaced with. It could potentially leave about a $20 billion hole in the state budget.
Yes.
Is the legislature and the governor taking this seriously?
Well, it's not a hole in the state budget exactly. It's a hole in the program. And the state.
Well, if they continue the program.
And the state would only be a hole if the state continued coverage for several million people who got coverage under Obamacare.
Right.
But it's not for certain. And I think the feeling is, hey, if it goes away, it goes away. We can't afford to kick up in $20 billion to keep it going.
And let's keep in mind, too, that Republicans in Washington have said they're going to replace it with something. So that $16 to $20 billion number may not all go away. It may look like something else.
Well, let me throw this one at you. What about a $100 billion problem? And that is, you know, we're talking about having a sanctuary state, or they're talking about having a sanctuary state in California. What if President Trump then says, you know what, we're going to cut off all federal funding, or he says he makes it a factor in the scoring process for federal grants. Should the governor of the legislature be legislative? Should they be concerned about this, or is President Trump just kind of blowing smoke?
Well, first thing first, presidents propose budgets. Congress appropriates money and makes a budget decision. There's a lot that has to be in stake. Two, it depends on how you measure federal money in California. I have spent an enormous amount of time lately trying to calculate that. And third, I would argue that sanctuary city is not a legal term. It's somewhat interpreted differently. We're talking basically about how much we're going to cooperate with deportation proceedings and deportation efforts. And I think that the president could make a push on some of it. But the dollar amount versus the political rhetoric, I think it's a real mismatch. The rhetoric is bigger than the money, I think.
Okay. Well, when we come back, we're going to talk about state expenses. Should we be concerned? That conversation in a moment. This is the Maddie Report. Welcome back. I'm Mark Kepler with the Maddie Institute. We're talking with Dan Walsh of the Sacramento Bee and John Myers of the LA Times. So, John, you've written that not all tax dollars are created equal because voters have decided that billions of dollars can hardly touch a politician's hands. In short, a good portion of the state budget is really on automatic pilot. So how much money does the legislature really have to deal with here?
Well, I mean, it's going to depend on the year, but I think the dominating part of the state budget, as we know from watching it all these years, is what happens to school funding. It's Proposition 98. Voters passed it back in the late 1980s, 1988. Generally earmarked somewhere around 40 cents of every dollar-ish in the state's general fund. But when you take that and then you take a lot of the other rules, I mean, we've had a millionaire's tax. We have money that automatically goes into a rainy day fund that comes from the most wealthy. You have more and more parts of the revenue picture that get pushed around. And advocates for some programs, mainly social services, have said for years, we're the ones without any protections. And so I think when you look at what lawmakers can do, yeah, they can move the revenue numbers. And I think that's why we were talking earlier. You see so much debate over what that tax revenue prediction is going to be. But after that, the pie gets a lot smaller.
Yeah, it's automatic. So, Dan, I want to ask you about one of the big things that John just mentioned. That's Prop 98. You noted that, quote, per pupil spending is up 50%. Over the last half decade, but the governor's taking a, quote, ultra-conservative, cautious approach, unquote, in his proposed budget, and that he's, quote, putting the squeeze on schools, unquote. Would the legislature go along?
That depends on those revenue numbers again. Yeah. I mean, it's automatic. If the revenues come in like the alleged analysts say there, that gives the schools another $1.5 billion. But it's kind of automatic, as we've been discussing before. Now, within that automatic business of Prop 98, the most complicated formula ever devised by the hand of man.
And the only infuriatingly
complex. And the person who wrote it died. Now nobody understands it. Within that, there's a lot of wiggle room. You can kind of move money around from one year to the next, and the governor's doing a lot of that. He's saying that the school's got too much money for the last 2 years, and so he wants to take it back in the new budget, and they're complaining about it. And they're saying so they get left with a net increase under his budget of $700 or $800 million, but that's just about as much money as the extra pension payments they're going to have to lay out are.
Yeah. Right,
so,
right.
So, I mean, it basically washes out.
So what about those pension payments? Yeah. I mean, school districts are going to get a lot bigger bill. So is the state, by the way.
Are local governments.
Right. Do you see any attempt to kind of go back at that issue and try to deal with public employee pensions?
There are certainly people in Sacramento who say, look, what we did a few years ago, the effort the governor left that was called reform, wasn't enough. We've got to go back and look at that. But definitely when those bills come due, I mean, the state's going to pay a higher portion into the CalPERS system first. Local governments are going to come and school districts are going to come somewhat after that. They're getting a little bit of a reprieve. But that's a big sticker shock at some point. And even then, that doesn't really address the long-term systemic issues in those pension funds. I wouldn't be surprised if we see it again. And then, of course, we get into this notion of, well, voters consider it in a ballot measure at some point. Who knows? But the pension questions aren't over now.
Big dollar ticket item. Dan, so what about transportation? You know, we had a special session last year. Nothing happened. The governor's proposed a bigger plan, slightly bigger plan this year for transportation. Despite, you know, widespread agreement, hey, this is a problem that needs to be addressed, it's remained elusive, some kind of resolution. You think something will finally happen this year?
I would count on it. There's a deadline now of April to supposedly get something done. Mm-hmm. But of course, we know deadlines in Sacramento. If something gets done in August, they would be happy. But, it's the bugaboo. The bugaboo is that you do it, you have to raise taxes. Republicans won't vote to raise taxes. Now, you say, well, about the supermajority, but I don't think you can get all the Democrats together to raise taxes. Some of those people from marginal districts, yeah, I want to stick my motors with some more taxes at the pump or no big...
And a lot of those are in the valley where people do a lot of driving, long distances.
And so it's a tough nut to crack. And the funny thing about it, even if they did what the governor wants, it really is kind of almost a drop in the bucket as to what's needed on the highway systems in California. Plus, you have other people. Local governments wants a piece of the pie. The transit systems want some of the money. And so whatever you do gets diluted otherwise, too. It doesn't all go into fixing potholes on the state highways.
And look how many other topics have been talked about in the time we've been talking about transportation. Climate change, 2 years of the legislation, water issues at the Capitol. This year we're talking about immigration and Washington. You keep wondering if transportation is that redheaded stepchild that never gets enough attention.
Well, let me give you another one. How about housing? Affordable housing.
Yeah.
So, the governor, everybody agrees there's a problem here, but the governor's budget proposed canceling $400 million in a set-aside for affordable housing. How likely is that to be reinstated by the legislature?
Well, the governor is proposing to take the money that he put on the table last year and pull it back because there wasn't a deal. I mean, and central to the housing issue, I think, in so many ways, and it's almost another show if we were talking about it, is this relationship between local government, state government. State has the mandates for the state. Locals don't want to be told what to do in terms of making the decisions about planning, and back and forth we go. But there does feel like there's more of a chance of critical mass showing up on this point. Now, people are really feeling it in so many communities.
And it's only $400 million. So I want to thank
it's really a real drop in the bucket.
Right, exactly. I want to thank our guests, John Myers from the LA Times, Dan Walsh from the Sacramento Bee, and also Mac Taylor, California's legislative analyst. If you want to stay up on current and stay current on local and state politics, you can follow us on Twitter and Facebook or sign up for our daily e-newsletter, The Maddie Daily, by logging on to our website. This is Mark Kepler for The Maddie Report. Thanks for joining us.
The views and opinions expressed on The Maddie Report are those of the individuals participating in the program and do not necessarily reflect those of the California Channel or The Maddie Institute. If you'd like to share your thoughts about the points and opinions expressed on The Maddie Report, visit our website at maddieinstitute.org.
The Maddie Report, Valley Views Edition, is a public affairs partnership between KMJ Radio, Cumulus Media, and the nonpartisan Maddie Institute, providing the Valley with valuable insight and analysis on politics and important public policy issues. This is KMJ.